Okay, welcome back. And this is another special program in our continuing series of radio programs on Morgellons. Morgellons syndrome, Morgellons disorder, Morgellons disease, Morgellons affliction. There are a lot of names that are attached to Morgellons. We just call it Morgellons around here for the most part. Up with us tonight, some very special people to talk about the very latest developments in the public sector research into this very mystifying disorder. And it is that. We certainly don't trust the government to come to our rescue, so we're doing it ourselves as a society which very much cares about its own and cares about getting to the bottom of mysteries like this. We do know one thing. The government knows in all likelihood a whole lot more about Morgellons than they will tell us now and perhaps in the near and maybe even the distant future. We'll have to wait and see. Cliff Mickelson is back with us tonight for 2 hours. Cliff has been afflicted with Morgellons syndrome for probably, I guess, 14 years now or thereabout. He's a remarkable man, a great friend of millions of Americans and people all around the world as well because of his great dedication to trying to bring the truth and the reality of this issue forward. And he's been a friend of this program for years now, and we're very happy to have him back tonight. Are you there, Cliff?
Yes, Jeff. Good evening.
Good evening to you, sir. And first of all, I should just say, and because I care, how are you feeling?
Actually, I'm doing quite well. I keep a positive attitude about life, and I just keep trucking forward.
Well, you take very good care of yourself, too, which is important, to put it mildly.
Yes, indeed.
All right, you were in Austin, Texas, for the, I guess it's the second annual Morgellons Conference?
Yes, the second annual Morgellons Conference. It was held April 4th in Austin, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and we had an excellent turnout, a great group of speakers, and a great presentation. Number of presentations were made. It was a complete success.
Were there any, we don't want to get into the minutiae right now, were there any major revelations, Cliff? How would you quantify the amount of forward progress we've made in the last year since the first Morgellons Conference down there?
I would describe the progress that we've made as being the kind of progress that you can put in the category of awareness. I would say that we've had a great deal more awareness come out of this whole issue mm-hmm. than we had just 1 year ago. As far as scientific progress, we're still working behind the eight ball, Jeff, sad to say.
Yeah.
But the awareness is coming along, and with the awareness will come the scientific progress.
Our efforts as a public to try to unravel this, and we have physicians, we have scientists and others who are working very hard to try to figure this out. How are they faring? Are they frustrated with the lack of honest, forthcoming cooperation with the government? Are they sick and tired of the diagnoses given to people which have nothing to do with the issues at hand? What's going on with that? How are the researchers doing?
Well, the researchers are actually very frustrated. They're working under financial handicap, because of course money is everything when it comes to things like this.
Sure.
The private researchers have very limited access to funds. The people do give haven't been able to give in the amounts that are required to really do the test and really mm-hmm. do the science that would get us somewhere. And, of course, I think the few researchers who actually tried to rely upon government assistance and government aid were rudely short-sheeted, because that just was not forthcoming. In fact, some of the scientists who volunteered to assist the government, when I speak of the government, I'm talking about the CDC,
right.
they were completely shut out. So we were somewhat disappointed, to put it mildly, about that. But, that's just we're going to keeping on.
In a general sense now, how many years has this been a front burner issue? What are we talking about, close to 20?
Yes, I would say 15, 20 years.
Because you were really in on
really
the first
come
wave.
On strong recently.
Yeah, you were on the first wave, so to speak.
There was a huge wave that struck there was a groundswell in the mid-90s, 95, 96, 97, when the first wave of this hit. And, of course, a lot of the awareness of what it actually was didn't really register with people until some years later due to the fact that this thing is so extremely bizarre and does mimic so many other illnesses, a number of illnesses all under one tarp, if you will. So it took a while for the word to get around that, hey, this isn't X, Y, or Z, this is something else. But the first real big wave did strike in the 90s, and I was part of that, yes.
The CDC research, the formal CDC effort, hiring Kaiser Permanente for pocket change to study Morgellons, to determine what it is or what it isn't, of course, was theoretically supposedly finished within a year. I think it started, let's just say in round numbers, about the beginning of 2008. And toward the end of 2008, they said that the entire research project was finished and that they were expecting to have results, I believe, by last December. Nothing was forthcoming in December. Here we are in April and still nothing. What's the status of the CDC's investigation as far as you can tell, Cliff?
Well, nothing from nothing is nothing, Jeff, and that's exactly what you got. We've got nothing. They underfunded this study, and in my opinion, in an attempt to probably kill it, they've been successful. You can't do a study of this magnitude with that kind of money. It barely pays the salary of one researcher, much less a whole team.
Absolutely.
So I'm not really sure what they're doing, and no one else is sure.
No.
They're very close to their chest about this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do know that there's a delay. The delay may well be a result of the increased awareness and the pressure therein. Let's hope that's certainly a part of it. If you go to rents.com, look on the left-hand side of the page. Near the top, you will find the Morgellons section. Look under Morgellons articles and reports, and the sixth story down there is one that Cliff Mickelson wrote shortly after the CDC Kaiser Permanente so-called groundbreaking Morgellons study was launched. And Cliff didn't waste any time, didn't mince any words. He called it, as I did, a complete fraud. And to this day, we have not changed our opinion or our impression. At all. Was there any talk at the conference about the big CDC Kaiser, I'm going to call it a cover-up rather than a study, because I think they know pretty damn well what this is all about. If not in specifics, they certainly know in generalities.
Yes, and the word's pretty much out among the community that this whole thing, it stinks to high heaven with the CDC. And among the researchers and the people there at the conference, it wasn't directly addressed, but there's a general feeling that is sorely lacking.
They didn't talk much about it, huh? Interesting.
Well, there was a lot of talk, nothing off the podium, but, among people in the groups afterwards, nobody really wanted to rock the boat too much, but everybody is aware, even the people in the mainstream now are coming to the conclusion that, hey, this thing is just a farce from the very beginning. And it was. It's a farce. I have no trouble saying that to anybody.
No, it was and it is. I would urge you to read Cliff's very succinct and very correct and accurate diagnosis of this study. Let me read just the end of it. Morgellons activists need to wake up and smell the coffee. The CDC has no intention of solving the Morgellons mystery. Those who think otherwise need to review the history of the CDC's hostile and dismissive interaction with the Morgellons community over the span of the last 8 to 10 years. Under modest scrutiny, it becomes painfully apparent that this study is a farce and a fraud. What is actually being sold to the gullible among us is smoke and mirrors. For a variety of hidden reasons, the CDC is offering up the public expedient of having done their part. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the daggers are being sharpened in the dark hallways of Kaiser and the CDC. Morgellons victims who, in their current desperation, rush to embrace these bureaucratic assassins of faith and hope would do well to wear extra body armor. Cliff Mickelson in that excellent essay at rents.com, the CDC Kaiser groundbreaking Morgellons study is a fraud. And again, nothing has changed. The only thing that has changed is that they didn't come forward with their obviously and very predictable results last year like they promised. And that's where that stands right now. Now, we have a break coming up in just a minute or two. Then we'll meet our first of two special guests tonight. Dr. Amy Withington, MD, and she's got a lot to say. She was at the conference as well. But briefly, Cliff, what do we know about the pathology of this issue now? Are we seeing more and more people dying from Morgellons without proper autopsy, without proper forensic work? Is that something that is being noted on the fringes?
Actually, that's kind of been a chronic issue all along. We're seeing quite a bit more of it. The problem is being just trying to identify exactly what the role of Morgellons is in these deaths. And of course, it's hard to do that when you've got an issue that is denied from the beginning. So you can't get a proper autopsy, and we're fighting that battle right now.
It's very difficult to get autopsies, and when you have DOP, delusions of parasitosis, being handed out still by dermatologists who are seeing Morgellons people and basically rejecting that reality, we got problems. All right, back in just a couple minutes. All right, we're back. I'm Jeff Rentz with Cliff Mickelson in our 18th special Morgellons radio program. Up now is a special guest joining us, Cliff. This is an extraordinary woman. She is an MD. Her name is Dr. Amelia Withington. I think she's called Amy by her friends. Dr. Withington was born in Concord, Massachusetts, while a student at Williams College. She collaborated with members of the staff at the Federal Centers for Disease Control. We're not going to hold that against her. to become the author of the book, Teenage Sexual Health. After graduating from medical school at the University of Texas Southwestern Med School in Dallas, she completed her residency at the Hahnemann University Hospital in Philadelphia. She is board certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. She is now an attending psychiatrist at the Crozier Chester Medical Center in Chester, Pennsylvania. Dr. Withington practices in a variety of outpatient settings, with an emphasis on collaborating in diagnosis and treatment of individuals with developmental challenges and co-occurring medical conditions. She was at the conference in Austin, Texas, and in 2007, rather, she contributed to developing the International Diagnostic Manual to help standardize the diagnosis and treatment of psychiatric conditions in those with developmental disabilities. She has recently helped to establish a specialty clinic for patients and families with Fragile X syndrome at the Elwin Institute in Media, Pennsylvania. Dr. Withington is currently working on a book about her experiences with Morgellons disease, which will incorporate her presentation on April 4th at the second annual Morgellons Conference in Austin. Welcome, Dr. Withington.
Thank you so much, and it's really an honor to be part of your 18th program on Morgellons or Morgellons disease. Both pronunciations are equally viable. I really appreciate your dedication to this issue.
Well, thank you. I've been inspired by some wonderful people, and certainly you're added to the list. Cliff and I go way back on this, and he has been just above and beyond heroic in stepping out and coming forward. Now, you have Morgellons.
That's right.
And what do you call it? A disease, an infection, a condition, a syndrome? What does the doctor say?
Well, it seems to be a chronic condition that tends to happen in people who may already be immunocompromised for some reason.
Right.
In my particular case, and so far with the data we have, it appears that about 95% of people who have Morgellons disease are eventually diagnosed as also having Lyme disease, which may have predated developing the Morgellons symptoms.
These could be parallel issues, though. They don't have to necessarily be linked, correct?
Correct. It is notable, however, that at the end of January of just this year, the National Institutes of Health finally recognized Morgellons disease by name with a diagnostic code.
Yeah, they gave it a code.
Characterized
yeah.
it as being a Lyme-associated condition.
Really? So they gave it a code so
yeah.
insurance can cover it. They gave it a Lyme-associated connotation. Now, what is that going to do to dermatologists who see Morgellons patients with lesions all over their bodies? They've got a code now. are they going to be more inclined to go ahead and use that code to allow for insurance payments and co-pays and all that?
I'm hoping that there will be some encouragement, given that it's been recognized by name by at least one government entity,
right,
while the other concentrates its efforts in just one state with a managed care organization for whatever reason. But that the NIH went ahead and did this seemingly independently, I think is encouraging. I think you have contact with Cindy Casey as well,
right,
who runs the New Morgellons organization and its website. And she's actually had feedback from dermatologists who say, oh, it's just the same old bunk. You know, for some reason they decided to attach a name to it, but there are many of us who just still don't believe in it anyway.
Well, that's unfortunately very true. And I know at least one dermatologist who is very bright, very capable, and dismisses all of them as just pickers.
I wish it were that simple.
I wish it was that simple, too. Now, a lot of folks, unfortunately, are pickers. You're a psychiatrist. You know that. It's one of those things, a chicken and an egg kind of a situation, too. Some people have been picking their entire lives, and they pick and pick, and then they become infested with the syndrome of Morgellons, and then they've really got one hell of an OCD problem, to put it mildly.
That may be. It's interesting because people who are knowledgeable about the real diagnosis of delusions of parasitosis note that it's quite rare. And
mm-hmm.
I said quite honestly in my presentation at the conference, I've never met a single person who truly has that diagnosis. There's always a reason.
Really?
I've been looking much more closely. Why are people picking at their skin?
Uh-huh.
And now I know to look. Is there something under the skin?
Right.
Is there something emerging that they're trying to get out? Sometimes there is. And we
yeah.
need to look again at where's that coming from. And no wonder they're irritated, you know?
Sure, of course. Now, the other thing is, the human body can be host to well over 130 different kinds of parasites, some of which manifest in the skin. And there can actually be little organisms that are in the skin that can drive people nuts, which are not Morgellons, per se. So it becomes a diagnostic, it's almost a quicksand issue for many, many doctors trying to figure this out. They don't know which direction to go, so they take the DOP, the easy way out, and from what I'm hearing, many of them are still doing that. And that's most unfortunate, to put it mildly. Stand by, if you would, Dr. Withington and Cliff, and we'll come right back. And, oh, Cliff, say hello to Dr. Withington.
Hi, Cliff.
Hi there. Hello, Amy. How are you?
Fantastic. Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Forgive my lack of propriety, please.
Not at all. We're old friends by now.
All right. Back in just a couple minutes. Okay, back with all of you great people and Cliff Mickelson and Dr. Amy Withington. Well, Amy, and Amelia is a beautiful name.
Oh, why, thank you.
Thanks to your parents, too.
Definitely.
Yes. When did you get Morgellons, and how do you think you got it? Because transmission remains a mystery.
It certainly does. I first had the symptoms almost exactly a year ago.
Oh, just a year ago. All right.
It came after an intensive period of working on my garden, ripping up vines and trying to clear away some of the vines that seemed to be trying to take over some of the shrubs and growth in my garden.
Uh-huh. Where do you live? What part of the country? Amy, what part of the country do you live in?
Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Interestingly, suburban Philadelphia.
All right.
And there's an interesting link here because the name Morgellons was rediscovered and coined by Mary Leitao, who lived in Pennsylvania at the time.
Mm-hmm.
She had noticed symptoms similar to mine in her 2-year-old son.
All
tried
right.
to find some kind of precedent in the medical literature, and all the way back in the 1600s,
yeah.
found a reference describing the symptoms exactly, written by a physician named Sir Thomas Brown, who observed this phenomenon in children who were ill in France, in the Morgellons region of France.
Right. All right, so you're out in your garden.
Yes.
Tell us what happened next.
Absolutely horrendous itching. just itching all night long, not able to sleep. I couldn't imagine what the problem was. I thought maybe I was allergic to a detergent or a medication I was taking, so I tried to eliminate all of those things. And eventually, my skin broke out and small dark specks appeared. And I assumed it was probably something like a scabies infestation.
Right. Where was the itching? Amy, where was the itching occurring on your body?
Mostly on my arms, actually, where I had had contact with vegetation. And this is often a link with many people who contract these symptoms. They've usually been in contact with soil or gardening or vegetation in some way.
Now, let me hasten to say one thing about that.
Yes.
I do not want people to think that by touching plants or touching the ground, the soil, they are necessarily directly accessing the active agent, whatever it may be, i.e. stemming from the soil or from the greenery itself. It may be something laying on the ground or laying on the plants that has been somehow put there, drifted there, or whatever. It's not necessarily the plant's fault.
Right. That could be a possibility. I think at this year's conference and last year's, Dr. Raphael Stricker, who works in San Francisco now, also with recently Dr. Ginger Savely, she just got her degree, has done some research that shows that there are very, very close similarities in the DNA between particularly the Lyme spirochete and a certain kind of agrobacteria.
Right.
Some of which is used in a genetically modified fashion in crops and agriculture. Apparently, it may be possible that there's genetic exchange, perhaps in that perfect medium of a tick's belly or an arthropod vector, and then once it's introduced into the skin of a susceptible person, it appears to me it tries to grow something, eventually the body recognizes it as foreign and kicks it out. And that exact process may have happened as far back as in France in the 1600s, but only immunocompromised children were manifesting that as their immune system started to rally and help them recover from the concurrent illness they already had.
Right. Well, we know that bacteria swap genetic material fairly easily. That's kind of one of their primary pastimes, so that's not a big surprise. So let's help people who may have itchy skin out there so they don't overly concern themselves or become obsessed with it. You did get itching sensation all over your body, essentially, especially the parts of your body that touched the plants and the soil and all that, your arms. Now,
I I had had those kind of symptoms less commonly in the year beforehand.
Oh.
Never a skin eruption.
Okay.
This was the first time there were actual skin eruptions and actually something produced that appeared foreign. And then that I went on an odyssey to try to characterize with various degrees of helpfulness by the medical professionals.
Amy, when your skin itched, how did it present? Were there bumps? Were there redness? Were there dry, flaky patches of skin like keratoses? Were there red welts? What did you see on your skin?
It started as welts, and then the areas opened and spread. It resembled most closely, in my particular case, pictures of discoid lupus lesions online. So I was combing the internet trying to find something that matched up and explain why this persistent
but nothing
problem
like,
wasn't responding to the typical scabies treatment, corticosteroid creams, things that would usually bring relief to a skin eruption.
Okay, nothing like keratosis, that kind of flaky, sun-damaged skin that people get and sometimes itches and they go to a dermatologist and they get them frozen off. Nothing like that.
No. In this particular case, the thing that I found online besides the discoid lupus lesions that most resembled it are so-called Norwegian scabies, where they're noted to be extremely resistant to treatment.
Huh.
Large open areas with a thick, crusty, keratin-like material. But almost, it's hard to describe what it's like, maybe a little bit like a very entrenched scab, but anybody who's seen it will understand what I'm describing. It isn't flaky, it isn't dandruffy, it doesn't brush off, it is adhered in place.
Now, scabies are not red, blue, black, and white, and other colored fibers moving under the skin.
Exactly.
Scabies are quite obvious. They are a little mold. Yeah, that's right. They're bugs.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. So then the second year, as it were, perhaps, your skin just began to break out. It opened up and it began weeping, and the itching, I guess, continued.
Yeah, something tipped the scales, and that something seemed to be a very intensive period of gardening where there was a lot of skin penetration, despite the fact that I was taking precautions, wearing gloves and long sleeves and so forth.
Were these thorned vines you're dealing with?
Yes, and because of the sensations, the redness, I thought perhaps I got exposed to poison ivy, poison oak.
Yeah.
It was of such a characteristic, I thought, gosh, if I had scabies and they got the poison ivy and oak oils on them and it's been spreading them through my skin, I tried to exhaust every hypothesis I could imagine because I'd never heard of Morgellons at that point.
Right.
I didn't know that such an entity could.
All right. Okay, we have to take a break. There has been a lot of momentum leaning in the direction of this agrobacterium theory that's what Morgellons is, or there's a genesis there of some kind. I'm not so sure. Yes, perhaps.
Probably
indeed.
Probably not the whole explanation,
no.
Though, unfortunately.
Right, right.
It'd be easier if it were.
And I point out, and I'm not suggesting that chemtrails are the cause of it either, at least chemtrails as we know them. We do know, we got a break here, but the government is doing all kinds of things over our heads. And we'll be right back in just a couple minutes. Okay, back with Cliff Mickelson and Dr. Amy Whittington, MD. All right, Amy, so the lesions broke out. We all know the drill by now. We've seen pictures. We've talked so many times to people who have had these things. We did. Cliff and I had a health professional on with us on the program before last, I believe, number 16, who worked in a large hospital up in the Northwest. And she said that there were a number of people on staff in her ward who have Morgellons, who wear long sleeves all the time to try to cover up the lesions on their arms.
Mm-hmm.
She's aware of them. She has a friend who works in an immediate care center in a strip mall or somewhere like that. And that woman told her that she sees Morgellons patients walk in there practically every day now. What do you think of those two statements?
It doesn't surprise me, actually. It seems that there is a historical precedent that this may have existed hundreds of years ago, but that was in an isolated region and was so unusual that this physician wrote about it in his memoirs. Something seems to have jump-started this process. I'm not sure what it is. Is it a combination of climate changes, pollutants? Are pollutants being taken from the environment and then the body's trying to process them and literally spit them out?
Right.
There are a lot of different possibilities, and nobody's sure what's happening.
Right. How was your presentation in Austin? What did you really present that others didn't? And what would you like to tell our audience tonight about that?
Well, as far as I can tell, my experience seems to be unusual only in that I'm only aware of three physicians who have gone public saying that they have this. I really appreciate that the other two besides myself, Dr. Gregory Smith and Dr. Beverly Drotter, have been supporting patients and helping spread information in
mm-hmm.
many different ways.
Right.
In my particular case, I really walked the same road as some of my patients in terms of being utterly baffled in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
Trying to understand it with a common hypothesis or solution. I had only had one outbreak, and at the time, there weren't any unusually colored fibers or really unusual particles. I could try to explain it away as some unusual manifestation of scabies. But I did have the good fortune to see a dermatologist who was willing to say, yes, there's something there. I'm going to look at it under the microscope. I don't know what it is. I've never seen this before. If you had scabies, you certainly blasted them into oblivion. But I think you have a chronic underlying infection. Let's talk about Lyme disease. that was the first clue about having those symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been symptomatic for several decades, really. My first exposure was in the late 70s. I had a bullseye rash, and nobody knew for sure what it was.
Right.
So I think I was susceptible, and fortunately that initial level of scrutiny and hypothesis on her part led me down the road to finding professionals who could help identify that it was Morgellons. And that happened last October at the ILADS conference, the International Lyme Associated Diseases Society.
Uh-huh.
The Lyme Disease Association co-hosted a conference in October in San Francisco, and Cindy Casey and Cliff Mickelson had a table of information, and I approached the table thinking, oh my gosh, something else I've never heard of that's associated with Lyme. It was the first clue I ever had that a single other person on the planet had experienced what I experienced.
And well, that must have been...
Fortunately, I met them when I did,
yeah.
Because my next outbreak had much more unusual manifestations of multicolored fibers, strange shapes, sparkle shapes. It was so bizarre. I couldn't have manufactured them with a delusion if I wanted to.
Right.
And I would have had a really hard time explaining that one away with the scabies hypothesis.
Were you able...
I convinced myself about with the first outbreak.
Right, all right. Were you able to deal with your Morgellons aside from or in addition to the Lyme? How did you treat the Lyme?
Treating the Lyme, I can't say enough how much I appreciate the ILADS and Lyme Disease Association communities, because I really had to do self-help. I'm fortunate that I could go online. I've been trained in the medical terminology. I started to realize I had at least one, maybe more, co-infections based on the symptoms.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Joseph Burascano and Pamela Weintraub gave fantastic presentations in my area. Douglas Fern with the Lyme Disease Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania put together. So I had like a crash course in what's involved with Lyme disease, and just tried to figure out what was affecting me, you know, get the antibiotics to try to address it. And I got significant relief, and that's the message of hope out there.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been cured yet in my particular case. I feel so much better than a year ago. It's just like a world of difference, and I really want to say for everybody out there, there's hope. It's real, and keep at it till you find someone who can work with you in the health profession to help figure out what's going to work for you.
Right, very good. Cliff, come on in here. You must have a couple questions for Amy.
Well, I was curious about one thing. She said something, and if I understood it correctly, it's a situation that I've seen over and over again. In fact, even in my case, it occurred the same way. I believe she said that she had an initial outbreak of minor itching or relatively severe itching that went away for a period of time, and then the full-blown attack came on some months or almost a year later. Was that correct?
Yes. There had been waxing and waning episodes of itching, and I just kept thinking, gosh, I must have some new detergent or lotion or something I should be avoiding. It got worse and worse, more frequent, but there was nothing that broke out on the skin that said this is an unusual presentation of something, but there was definitely something brewing. That's the best way I can put it.
Right. Well, the reason I was asking that question, Amy, is because I wanted to alert the listeners out there that this is a very common way that this thing first manifests itself. You'll have an initial outbreak, and many people have reported this to me, and I've experienced it myself, your initial outbreak of itching, which actually comes with a period of time that follows it. There'll be 6 months to a year before your next real outbreak occurs. And when the second outbreak occurs, you're usually full-blown.
Well, I lost the line again, I think.
No, you're here, Amy.
Oh, good. Okay.
You're there. Amy, do you think, as many do, and I do, and I think Cliff and I are pretty much on the same page, that this, whatever it is, and I'm going to separate it from Lyme. There may be an associative...
This is definitely a separate, possibly related, but a
all
separate
right.
thing, too.
Let's keep it. I want to keep it a separate issue for our conversation as much as I can.
Okay.
Do you feel that this goes systemic after perhaps the... And is this a possible scenario? You've got the initial minor itching. It subsides. It retreats. It goes away. Do you think that the Morgellons syndrome at that point then goes internal potentially, it goes systemic. And do you think that the full-blown manifestation in the skin with the lesions, the fibers, and all the other formations that come out of the body, maybe 6 months, maybe a year later, it varies from person to person. Do you think that that is a later stage in the cycle of Morgellons affliction?
I've given it a lot of thought, and I think it's really helpful when people sign up Randy Wymore's research website at the University of Oklahoma, Health
right.
Sciences University. My impression is that the phenomenon of Morgellons, what distinguishes it from Lyme and some of Lyme's co-infection, is Morgellons seems to be in the dermis. And that can be both the interior and exterior lining of the body. But whereas Lyme, Bartonella, Babesia, they can go into connective tissue, within organs, and so forth, it seems Morgellons is on the surface, and that what distinguishes it so vividly is that the body tries to cast whatever this is off, and you have a physical manifestation on the surface of the skin. Or, you know, some people will see, you know, in the lining of their nose, their mouth,
sure.
mucous membranes possibly, but, you know, in that dermal layer, whether interior or exterior.
Are you aware of surgery and surgical results which have shown masses of colored fibers in knee joints, for example?
I am not aware of that quite as much. I have certainly, though, seen how vividly a Woods lamp turned on the skin will show
mm-hmm.
a huge network of fluorescent fibers under the skin.
So just
and
a black,
really what Cindy
just
and Cliff
a black
were able
light.
To demonstrate in their mini clinic at the Lyme disease.
You're talking about just a, you're talking about a black
and
light.
There it's not, and you uh-huh. have two people standing next to each other, shine the lamp on one, and they light up like the Illustrated Man from the Ray Bradbury stories.
Uh-huh.
And the other person, it doesn't light up because there isn't anything underneath.
Now this is a black light, correct?
I think it's a sort of, it's able to elicit fluorescent potential in fibers.
All right. Okay. Amy, is there anything you'd like to leave us with? We are closing out this hour, and we really thank you for being here.
We're still in the information gathering stage, so get online, go to www.thenmo.org. There are links to Randy Wymore's site. Share your information. The more information we have, the more we can try to figure this out. And don't give up hope. There's relief.
Very good. Thank you very much, Amy, and good luck to you.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, thanks. Okay, Cliff, very interesting woman, a health professional and medical doctor. Got this. She feels the only thing she can connect it to is working outside in the garden. And we've heard that before. All right. We'll be back with Cliff Mickelson in just a few minutes as we step off into our second hour of our 18th special Morgellons Update presentation on radio after this. Okay, welcome back. Hour number two of our 18th special Morgellons radio program. Cliff Mickelson is with me, and Cliff has been virtually a guest on practically every program we've done on this. Cliff, you and I and others in the community, and this may be frustrating for some who are involved with this. I don't know. There seems to be, not a split, but there seem to be groups of people going in different directions now, rather than the cohesive, energetic push toward areas that have been pretty well researched by independent researchers and would point in a specific general direction as to where to look and what to consider and how to try to evaluate this thing. And I'm talking about, with no disrespect whatsoever to Dr. Withington or anyone else who believes, as she does, that this is essentially a skin disorder, but that the Morgellons syndrome is absolutely systemic, goes probably into every organ of the body. The brain has certainly been found inside the knee joints of one woman, Jan Smith, who had both of them replaced, and that in, as I mentioned, in all likelihood, or certainly in some likelihood, the potential exists that the skin manifestation, certainly the full-blown Morgellons skin manifestation, could be a later stage of this affliction. And I don't want to put words in yours or anyone else's mouth, but after doing this for all of these years, that's my general opinion, that there is a fragmentation, as it were, perhaps driven by confusion, hope, denial, by all kinds of things, that is going to keep this community potentially chasing its tail.
Well, yes, absolutely chasing its tail. And a lot of that, I believe, is not by accident, but by design. Of course, when you have an issue like this without the central strong leadership or without any strong central research that you can point to, it's a free-for-all as far as the theories of what's causing it. And that does seem to serve the best interests of some of the powers that be that as it may, it could be coincidence or it could be by design. But we've got an issue here where if we don't get that research and if we don't get that solid scientific positive movement forward, we're going to continue to be divided and remain conquered.
Would you have any serious issues with my summation there?
No, actually, I would like to say that I think that Dr. Withington may have not completely understood your question because she addressed the skin issue, but it's common knowledge, and I believe she knows this as well, and she's probably experienced it, that Morgellons does affect you systemically. The brain fog, the Morgellons objects in the urine and in the feces that show up,
We've done programs on the often withering psychological and emotional devastation that Morgellons brings about in relatively short order in some cases.
Yes, and it affects the body in a host of ways, more than just simply dermatological. And I know that that Amy also understands that. I think she was just addressing one part of your question. Probably
very good.
Really,
yeah.
Get all of it.
Well, she's only had it for a year too, so.
Yeah. Brain fog and all the other effects of this, the malaise, the depression, on and on. I mean, you can list the loss of vision, the blurring, the loss of hearing that comes with it. I mean, there's just an endless list of symptomologies.
Right. I worry also about hustlers and con artists suggesting cures for this issue. There are no cures. None. We found one product that I have actually the evidence in hand, one product that claims to be a certainly if not a cure, a powerful destroyer of the Morgellons syndrome to a large degree, a great tool, a great attacker of Morgellons. And what the product is 59¢ a bottle fruit and vegetable wash, as sold in practically every store in Mexico for 50 or 60 cents, something like that. It's being imported up here. It's essentially the same product with a different label on the bottle. So you've got to be careful about what's going on out there. And
yes, and that same product's being sold for 50 times what it costs to buy. And you know, the market's full of scams and ripoffs like that. So people, please be careful. Please beware. And as Jeff said, there is no cure right now. We're working to find out what this is, and that has to be done first before it can be cured.
And I again go back, and I've worked very hard with Dr. Patricia Doyle, PhD, to bring light to the Lyme disease issue. And I don't want people to link these two together. Some associative connectivity. I don't know. Maybe in symptomology, but. Other than that, Cliff, I would be very hesitant to say that there's a direct physical connection between the two.
that hasn't been proved, and it's, although 95, as they say, I don't really know for sure that that's the true number of people with Morgellons have Lyme. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's a link. It doesn't mean anything at all, really. It just means that you've got a compromised host and a potential for another infection.
Indeed. All right. All right. We have another special guest to join us this hour. Her name is Cindy Casey, and I believe she's standing by there. Are you there, Cindy? I'm not hearing her. All right. Well, we'll keep trying to get her up on the phone here. Tell us about Ms. Casey, if you would, Cliff.
Well, Cindy Casey has been a wonderful, wonderful spark plug for the Morgellons issue. She has been in the forefront of this fight from the very beginning, just about. Of all the people that I know with this affliction, Cindy is probably one of the worst afflicted, yet it hasn't slowed her down in the slightest. She's the owner of the Charles E. Holman Foundation site, the NMO.org site, as it were, which is one and the same. She was an original board member for the Morgellons Research Foundation, and she and her husband, Charles, before he passed on, were instrumental in making Morgellons a household word and in bringing it to everybody's attention.
Right. All right. Now, tell us a little bit more about the confab in Austin, Texas. How many people showed up this year as opposed to last? About the same, more or less?
We had a slight increase in general attendance. We had a number of excellent speakers there, some of the more well-known luminaries in this field. Of course, Dr. Wymore, Randy Wymore from the Oklahoma University of Oklahoma was there. We had Ray Stricker, who is very prominent in this movement and has done a lot to give us credibility with the medical community. He was there, as was Ginger Savely, who runs a practice in San Francisco. And there were a number of other speakers there, including Dr. Withington, who did a marvelous presentation. When Cindy Casey had a CD made of this conference, and when it comes out, it'll be available to the general public. And all of these people put on wonderful presentations.
Very good. I hear
a lot of them shared their stories.
I hear a young woman clearing her throat as if to say, "I'm here."
Hi, Cliff.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
Glad to have you. All right.
Good to be here.
How long have you had this this affliction?
I really knew there was something wrong in 1997. However, it wasn't until 2003 when the symptoms began to just become unbearable.
Hmm.
So a long time, too long.
Is there anything in your history that has given you enough relief over a longer period of time that you would be happy to recommend it to others who are suffering with it? I'm not talking about a couple of weeks. I'm talking about months. Something that would really, in your mind, have, in your case, pushed this issue into not necessarily remission, but certainly a lower profile.
Well, Jeff, every situation is unique. And especially with this disease, it seems as though something that may help one person is not as effective treatment for the next person. So each person kind of reaches their own level with what works for them. And I will share that the medication that has worked the best for me to keep this to where I could tolerate it and continue to live with it is ivermectin. And that is what I have chosen to keep mine at a tolerable level. And I do alternate with some other antiparasiticals and antibiotics treatment for Lyme disease. So
you're staying
that's
away.
What I use, but that doesn't necessarily mean that will be the drug of choice for the next person.
I understand. That's an antiparasitic, ivermectin. It's commonly used by veterinarians, in fact.
Yeah.
So you're staying away from the doxycycline, the heavy antibiotic regimens?
No, I'm not staying away from that. I do heavy antibiotic regimens. Doxycycline was not one that seemed to help me, but I have used a variety of other antibiotics, and I still go back to those at times when this gets really bad, and I feel like I need to pound it with treatment again. So I periodically go back to another month or so or 6 weeks of strong antibiotic treatment, and I switch them off often.
All right. Okay, Cindy, hold on if you would. We'll be right back as Cliff Nicholson and I and all of you folks continue with our 18th special Morgellons Radio broadcast. Okay, welcome back. We're with Cliff Nicholson and Cindy Casey, Morgellons activists and leaders in the field, a very confused field. Cindy, how have you, in your view, watched the progress of the spread of Morgellons affliction, Morgellons syndrome, since you first became aware and then able to identify what it was you had? Are you seeing more people with it? Do you go out in public? Are you able to pick up these lesions and see people trying to hide them? What kind of things do you notice?
Yes, since I've had this, Jeff, I have noticed some, probably maybe three or four people out in the general public. I don't see it all the time. And as a nurse, I was working for several years when I had this affliction, and I did inspect patients who had any kind of skin disorder, and I think that I may have only seen it one time in the hospital with patients. And
how long ago was it that you were working in the hospital with patients?
I was working full time from 1981 until 2005.
Okay.
So I was working for a couple years, even being covered with these lesions, and of course when I. After I knew what this was, which wasn't until 2004, I would definitely bring it to doctors' attention. I mean, and with the one patient that I did have in the ICU that I thought could have been this. So I can't really imagine seeing a patient as a nurse and then not reporting it to anybody. So,
How widespread do you think it is now?
It seems to be pretty widespread. It's hard to know because we only have online registration, so people have to seek us out or hear one of these programs like you're doing or some of the media ways that we've been able to get the word out. We were on Coast to Coast last night and Mystery ER and different media things. We will see an influx of people who register after those media presentations, but really, the patients have to seek us out. So we have no way of knowing exactly how widespread it is, but we're getting new people every single day, quite a few of them. And during times like this with lots of media coverage, we get a lot more.
There are probably a lot of people who would rather not even begin to confront the concept that they have something like this, and they cover up and they withdraw. And they become reclusive, and they don't go out and interact.
That's true, Jeff. A lot of people are afraid to come forward, and people may not have good support from their families or friends, and that even makes it harder, and their doctors may have told them they're delusional. So a lot of people may have withdrawn, but it seems like the more that we get the word out there, the more comfortable people are with coming out of the closet, so to speak.
Right. The emotional and psychological impact of Morgellons seems to be almost universal. There are exceptions, but it can be very difficult for people because they don't know what's happening to them. And the hardest thing to do is actually, it's an old expression, is to see ourselves as others see us. And so there's certainly denial involved in some of these cases. I've talked to people over the years about this now. What is your view on the emotional, neurological aspect of Morgellons and how it afflicts most people? Are there any generalities that you can come up with?
Well, as an overall statement, it's a devastating thing to have emotionally and psychologically and physically for so many reasons. Number one, one of the big things, it is totally disfiguring. My skin is now covered with scars pretty much from head to toe. I'm covered with open lesions and scars. I have these Morgellons in all the different stages. Some are healed over and are just hypopigmented scars now. Some are still open lesions with dark scabs on them, and it's an ugly disfiguring disease. So that's a major impact psychologically and emotionally to have that change in body image. And the other thing is, we're not people who like who are used to the idea of being chronically ill. So with any chronic illness, it's hard to face that emotionally and psychologically, just because you don't want to be a victim. You don't want to be the patient. And I've always just been the nurse and not the patient. So that's really hard. And then the other part is that the disease seems to have the neurological effects, which does seem to affect our brain. Of course, we have no idea whether there are fibers present in our brain or there has been no studies to show us where these fibers are located, although neurological effects of this disease can come across through the brain fog and the lack of ability to communicate like
it's
we once did.
Certainly suggestive, at the very least, of a brain penetration because of the things and more that you've just mentioned.
Yeah, it's possible, but there are a lot of diseases that can cause brain dysfunction, but anatomically, we have no way besides a brain biopsy to know what is happening in the brain, and that's a pretty invasive procedure.
It is. however, we have autopsies. Now, I'm going to ask you, we have a break coming up here, but do you know of any Morgellons victim or victims who have honestly and properly been clinically, forensically autopsied? And you can answer that when we come back on the other side of the break. We keep hearing stories that to date we have not been able to have that luxury of one honest, forensically accurate, unbiased autopsy, studying all the major organs, looking for fibers, looking for penetration, looking for signs and symptoms of Morgellons syndrome to look at, to study. So we'll find out what Cindy has to say about that and hear from Cliff as well on that. And we invite you to listen to all of our now 18 Morgellons special programs for free at rents.com anytime you'd like, and please do download them and share them any way you wish. We are doing our very best and have for years to try to help. Back in a minute. All right, let's get right back to our guests, Cliff Mickelson and Cindy Casey. Cindy, Dr. Randy Wymore has been working for years on this, and Cliff, you know Randy as well. I guess he was at the conference?
Yeah, I think Cindy dropped Jeff. We'll get her right back. Yeah, sure. Randy was at the conference. He gave him an excellent presentation.
What's going on? He's the lead, the point man in this. He's our scientist. What's he done? What has he achieved? What has he presented? What are his beliefs at this point over the last 2, 3, 4 years? You can't speak for him, but what did he impart to those at the conference in terms of what he's learned about where we are, where we're going?
Well, Randy's been rather hobbled by a lack of funding as well. Of course, it's the same old story, but he has been able to establish beyond a shadow of a doubt, of course, that we're not dealing with regular manufactured fibers. Of course, we've known that now for some time scientifically. He's been able to establish that there's no DNA from Colambola involved in this, and that was, of course, one school of thought. That remains a fractious view, but I agree with him on that. And he's currently involved in attempting to set up some spectrographic readings and things like that. So he's moving forward as best as his time will allow and his funding.
All right. Cindy, what about autopsies? These are essential for us to know.
Absolutely. And I did want to answer that question. I am aware of at least two patients that I know for sure have had autopsy tissues and materials sent from their bodies to research.
These are deceased?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Yes, and that's in at least two patients.
Not just biopsies. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, maybe the problem is a lot the deaths that occur with people who have Morgellons disease is largely due to suicide. People can't deal with the situation, and with suicide deaths, of course, they're unexpected, and grieving families of those type of patients are not prepared to face decisions of autopsies right away. And of course, if it's not a coroner's case, you know, an autopsy is a quite expensive endeavor for a patient's family to proceed with that. So we feel very, very fortunate that tissue samples from two patients that I'm aware of have gone to research.
And?
And
what do we know?
We don't know. Dr. Wymore is working on trying to figure out what this disease is, and a lot of tests have been done.
Does he have the tissue samples or some of them?
Yes, uh-huh.
All right. Doesn't seem like it would be too difficult to do a search of any major body organ to look for fibers or evidence of other Morgellons manifestations. Does it, Cliff?
Well, I don't think he was able to access the entire body. I think he only received certain parts or partial shipments of some of the organs. I'm not really clear on what he actually received, but I do know I don't believe he got the entire body.
No, he doesn't get the entire body, and I'm not aware of any hardly situations where that would occur. But tissue samples is what has been sent from autopsy material, and of course he can scan for fibers just like he will be able to do that with live patients, but finding those fibers, does that tell us anything? Well, not yet, unfortunately.
How important do you think that is? I mean, we've been dealing with this for 14, 15 years now. Isn't it time that we had a thorough forensic examination of a Morgellons victim? I'm speaking somewhat rhetorically here, but...
Absolutely. I mean, time is the slowest for those of us who are suffering from this ailment.
That's the point.
I mean, we are ready to have done this many, many years ago. So
right.
Funding is a huge issue there, that it costs a lot of money for clinicians to be able to thoroughly put a patient through all kinds of examinations from head to toe. This is the research funding that we so badly need.
What's it cost to do a thorough, honest, I don't want to sound conspiratorial here, but I mean a real honest forensic autopsy. What's it cost? Does anybody know?
I'm not sure actually how much an autopsy costs. I hate to even venture to guess,
well,
but
we need to
say at least $1,000 to do an autopsy. And all that does is provide tissue. That doesn't give us any answers to the cause of this disease.
Well, I think we need to get somehow further down the road on this. We've got to find out once and for all and get some benchmarks laid down about the systemic nature of this syndrome. We can't continue to play games. Well, we think it is. We think it's that. We can't do that. It's
right.
been 14, 15 years.
That's one of the things we're up
against, Jeff. Yeah, the more funding
really
we get,
hard.
The more able we will be able to do that, hopefully. That's why we try and raise funds for research purposes so that more testing can be done. But conventional testing, what is known to medicine, does not pick up this disease. So we are completely looking at something that is totally different than anything any known test is going to pick up.
Yeah, I understand.
Right. If I could jump in real quick,
please.
Jeff, I think what Cindy just said is a real key point, because one of the things you've got to do is start from ground zero, because you have to first develop the test to identify what it is you're dealing with, since none of the tests that the standard laboratories are applying show anything. So it's almost like we're dealing with something that is completely immune to the current arsenal of tests in the medical arsenal. So we're having to not only get money for the test, but money to develop the test.
Well, it doesn't take but a 20 or 30 power scope to find fibers.
Right. That's true.
Let's get a liver. Let's get a kidney. Let's get a brain and simply do some sectioning and a 20 power scope. I mean, I'm not a professional pathologist, but this is really elementary stuff. We're not looking for tiny viruses that are hiding out in some strange neurological corner of the body. We're looking for fibers. We're looking for other growths
and
Morgellons manifestations.
Fibers, Jeff, it's still going to be the same technique to go ahead with spectroscopy and FTIR and forensic studies, just like it would
be to
try and figure out what they are composed of.
I'm just trying to ascertain once and for all that this is a systemic problem, and that is still up to debate, according to some, and I think it's
past time. I don't think it's, in my opinion,
I'm not aware of anyone that would debate that issue because of the vast array of symptomology of involved in this. I'm not aware of any clinicians or patients, for that matter, that would disagree that this is a systemic disorder.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I've talked to others who would disagree, and I'm glad that we are all together on that and that you're hearing the very same thing from the majority of the community. That's important.
Yes, absolutely. And I agree with Cliff on what Amy absolutely realizes this has systemic manifestations. And so what we know and can see and can prove right now is what's going on in the skin.
All right. Very good. Mm-hmm. Stand by. Back in just a couple minutes. Okay, and back to Cliff Nicholson and Cindy Casey. What about diet? Does diet play a role in mitigating, relieving symptoms in any way, shape, or form? People on really good, healthy diets with a good, healthy immune system, are they doing better, Cindy, or does it kind of not matter?
Well, I have heard from some patients who feel like eating sugars and carbohydrates may exacerbate this illness and cause more itching. I haven't really noticed that so much with myself, and so diet doesn't seem to play a role with mine. And for the most part, most patients don't either. There is a small group of patients who feel like this may come somehow from food, but as far as we know, our research has made no link to that.
Cliff, Lori just wrote in and advised that an autopsy is $1,700 to $3,500. So it's something that's
really
well within reach of the community. Should someone pass on from this and the family is agreeable, a full and honest forensic pathological examination ought to be done. And again, in this day and age, I don't put anything past anybody. Anything can be corrupted. We know threats are out there. They're being used for a variety of purposes in this society of ours. So I don't know. I don't know where we're going to go with this.
Well, I would like to add one thing to what we were talking about before the break, Jeff, and that is that I believe Cindy and I and Amy too, we're all on the same page with you concerning the autopsy. That needs to be done, and it's an outrage that it hasn't been done. Unfortunately, it's not quite as easy as it seems because there's just not really the support structure in place at this point in time to get that body when it dies. We've had just a few cases where we're even able to get any kind of of tissue. But it is a simple process, and it should be done. It needs to be done. And I think maybe we could put together some kind of task group to maybe set up a system so we can do that, Cindy. And
yeah,
I'm sure that Amy would agree with that.
Yeah, there would be some preparation for a patient that have those wishes. And maybe this is a good reminder to us to fill out the legal paperwork that gives permission and lets our families and our next of kin know what our wishes would be.
Right.
Yes. And, you know, it's too bad that they lost Jan Smith's knee because there was some interesting stuff found in that. But, maybe Jan would be willing to donate something else if she goes back in for surgery. Who knows?
Well, she's lost both knees. So she's out of knees.
Both knees.
Yeah. Yep, and they found fibers in both of them.
That's right. Unfortunately, we don't have those knees at this point in time, so we're starting from ground zero. And I think what
Cindy
just said is
pathological reports from that.
You have to
contact
Jan.
We're not sure what happened to those.
I do know that the second surgery Jan had for a knee replacement was done in a essentially a moon-suited environment, oxygen. It was a very secure oxygen and a surgical room. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know.
But I agree, Jeff, and I think you brought a good point up that, and I'm willing to work with Cindy and Amy and anyone else out there who wants to work with us, and let's do that. Let's set up the group that we need to do and the groundwork that we need to do to obtain that kind of an autopsy.
Is the community at large headed in a cohesive enough profile to get somewhere? How fractious are things? You used the word earlier, Cliff, and I know in these kinds of things, when you've got snake oil salesmen preying on people, you've got terribly depressed and people who have been compromised mentally from the Morgellons itself, not to mention the psychological devastation of having it. You have people who are afraid to go around loved ones. We don't understand the transmissibility of it. We don't understand the vectoring of it. If the government wanted to keep the community divided, the government would have a fairly easy time of it, in my humble estimation.
Absolutely. And, you know, this community is already so fractured, and because of the fact that you have the victims themselves attempting to put together the movement, and all of the mental and other physical manifestations that are anchors around your knees as a result, you know, it's just there's no progress at all that could be tied to groups. However, you know, we have a group with Cindy's, with the Charles Holman Foundation, and in some extent with the Morgellons Research Foundation that form nucleuses that we can use to push forward, and that's what we've been doing. And, you know, Cindy and the Charles Holman Foundation have done a wonderful job. We're working towards these goals, and I think we just keep the group small. The larger you try, if you try to work as an umbrella, you end up with all this fraction fighting, and it's just a negative all the way around.
What, Cindy, is your expectation of the vaunted CDC Kaiser Permanente Morgellons research program? What do you expect?
Well, Jeff, I try to remain hopeful. However, I am very disappointed in the lack of updates that we really don't hear anything from.
Yeah,
them.
What updates?
Thousands of people chomping at the bits here, desperate for any information. And the last letter they put out, I believe, was in December, and it basically said the same thing as the letter before that.
And to this date, Cliff Mickelson, the feds, the Kaiser doctors, and the CDC have not begun to avail themselves of the wealth of data from the actual Morgellons community itself.
Absolutely, they have not. In fact, they actually have shunned the research that has been done. That they refuse to deal with any of the work that Randy Wymore has done or any of the other people in this field. They don't deal with any of the work that Ray Stricker or Ginger Savely have done. They're completely isolated and prefer to be that way, and it tells you something right
there.
That
part of this conundrum is absolutely beyond me, why they do not seem to have any interest in hearing from those clinicians who have been seeing these patients and dealing with this disorder for years.
All right, so I guess we've got just about 5 minutes left. What haven't we touched on, Cindy Casey, that you'd like to put on the table here?
Well, I would like to just, if there's people out there listening that may have symptoms of this, I would like to just let them know they're not alone and that we are making progress in medical education, and we are learning bits and pieces of more about this disease. We still don't know the cause, but we are making progress, and I want to urge people who think they have it to go ahead and register with the database at Oklahoma State University, and on our website, each page has a link in the right upper hand corner to OSU's database, and the personal information is protected by federal HIPAA regulations, so it just takes a couple minutes, so go ahead and register, because the more numbers we have, the better off we are in the long run. So just keep the hope and network with others. There's a lot of support forums. There's a lot of support groups that are cropping up all over the nation and even in other countries. So hang in there. We're gonna get this figured out.
All right, Cindy. Thanks so much for being here tonight. I appreciate
it.
Thank you, Jeff. And for everything you've done. Thank you. All right. Cliff, just a couple minutes left. When you left Austin, how did you feel?
I was Well, I felt I had some mixed feelings. Of course, I didn't really expect that we would have a lot of stunning scientific revelations come out of this conference, and in that, that was the case, unfortunately. But I was also exhilarated to realize that there has been a lot of progress, and that the public awareness is probably the first step that, and the most important step in this whole process towards solving this mystery. And the public awareness has risen exponentially in the last few years. I feel like we've come in from the wilderness. When you think back 5, 10 years ago where we were wandering in the wilderness, it's easy to get depressed about the lack of what appears to be the lack of scientific progress at this point. But progress is being made, and most of it is in the foundational groundwork stage of public awareness. And with public awareness will come progress.
All right. When you travel around, Cliff, are you concerned about the vectoring issue at all? Personally, do you talk to others about it? Because we don't know how it spread. And we do know that people in close proximity to Morgellons sufferers don't get it. We know that people who are completely isolated and have no apparent contact get it. I mean, it's like all bets are off.
Yes, that one's a real puzzler. Of course, this thing does seem to be prevalent in certain states, but it's found everywhere around the world. How people exactly transmit this, we just don't know. And, of course, that's, once again, the we don't know thing, and it is very frustrating for us. However, I would say that it's quite possible to find the actual fiber evidence of this affliction in all kinds of environments, including hotels, in the food, everywhere around. So it's pretty widespread.
Now that's important, and we've talked about that before. Morgellons fibers can be found in hotels. They can be found in any public location. They have been found all over the place. They're there. So I guess we are living literally in an environment that is, shall we say, Morgellons friendly.
Increasingly so.
Yeah. And on 7 different continents now?
7 different continents. You name it. It's everywhere. I have a file that's full from all around the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's hope in the next year things change. We'll do another program, an update along the road here, perhaps with some health professionals who want to talk in more detail about this, because I do fear, and I think you share this same fear, that this disorder is really all over the place. Cliff, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. And once again, it's been a real pleasure. And I think the Morgellons community in general, I speak for all of them, and we thank you for all you've done for us.
All right. Well, I'm honored to be able to do what I can. Take care. Cliff Mickelson. And thanks to all of you for being here. We'll be back in 21 hours. In the meantime, we'll be with you at rents.com.